You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up after 6 on 1A+, Jen White asks, who showed up for the Democrats? And how many Republicans are now rethinking who they want at the top of their ticket in 2024? That's coming up after 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, tomorrow is the national release for the sequel to Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. Expectations are super high for this superhero film. The 2018's Black Panther was not only extremely financially successful at the box office, it also won a trio of Oscars and was the first movie from the genre to get a Best Picture nomination. In making the sequel, the production team also had to work in the emotional and physical shadow of the late Chadwick Boseman. The actor who played the Black Panther in T'Challa in 2018 died of colon cancer in 2020. And ahead of this new movie's opening, we're going to talk about the historic rise of this particular superhero and where the franchise goes from here after such a difficult loss. And we want to hear from you. Were you a fan of the 2018 Black Panther movie? Are you planning to see Wakanda Forever? And if you've read the graphic novels along the way, what do you have to add to the story? What do you think of the adaptations for the big, big screen? Join us, 800-642-1234, or email us, ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Brian Carr. He's an associate professor of communication, information science, and women and gender studies at UW Green Bay. He is also the author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. And Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a thrill to be here.
And usually we would give you the origin story of a superhero character and where they're coming from, but let's do the real world origin story of the Black Panther. How did this character originate?
So this is a character who originates in issues number 52 and number 53, I believe, of the Fantastic Four series. He is created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. And this was an attempt by Lee and Kirby to essentially try to tell a different story about Africa. If you look at a lot of how Africa and its people were portrayed in comics at the time, it was very regressive, very stereotyped, and quite frankly, very racist. So the attempt was, well, what if we told a story about an African nation with a king who was a scientist, not only a great scientist, but a great warrior, but also led a very technologically advanced nation beyond anything even America and the great Reed Richards and the Fantastic Four could come up with. And so that is really kind of the origin of this. And it's worth noting, he sort of predates the real life Black Panther Party by a couple months. Those issues come out, I believe, in the summer of 1966. And then it's a couple months later, we see the Black Panther Party actually start in Oakland, California. So that, as you might imagine, that led to some challenges for Marvel from a branding standpoint for a few years.
So Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, and I think a lot of comic book, every comic book fan would know their names. Here's some middle-aged Jewish guys from New York who created the Black Panther. Were they Afrofuturists? What did they say about their creation?
Well, I would certainly be hard-pressed to say they were themselves Afrofuturists. I don't think they knew what the word for that would be, because, you know, certainly it wasn't something that was on their mind. I think they definitely saw the opportunity, you know, as you mentioned, these are two middle-class Jewish guys from New York, working-class guys, especially Jack Kirby was. He grew up, you know, he was not from wealth. He was a kid who was going out getting the scraps on the street, that kind of thing. But he had a lot of friends from different cultures, different backgrounds. He had white friends, black friends, and so on and so forth. And, you know, he would say in later years, like, I drew Black Panther because I'd never really put any of my black friends. I had black friends and I never put them in my comics. And I thought this was an opportunity to kind of rectify that. And Stan Lee would also, for his part, kind of talk about like how this was an attempt to, you know, they always said the Marvel universe is the universe outside your door. And so there was this kind of push at a lot of the sort of editorial level of Marvel to include and sort of tell stories from these kind of perspectives and viewpoints you weren't necessarily going to get in a lot of other comics and a lot of other media at the time. Now, again, it should always be noted that, you know, when we talk about comics history, there's always a bit of, you know, ambiguity about the truth and sort of where things came, because nobody's writing anything down and a lot of people want to try to make themselves look good. you know, we know basically that, you know, these were not people writing from the black perspective, but they were certainly people who were sympathetic.
Our guest is Brian Carr, associate professor at UW Green Bay and author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Now, on to the character itself, T'Challa, the king of Wakanda, who is the Black Panther as a superhero. And one of the things that stands out to me as this superhero is you have Batman, who has all this wealth, Iron Man, who has all this wealth, and their superheroes seem to come from their infinite amounts to spend. You have Spider-Man, who's bitten by a spider. You have the Hulk, who's a radioactive accident. But for T'Challa, where do his superhero powers come from?
So this is actually something they don't really elaborate on too much, but eventually they do reveal. And this is something, you know, when we talk about superheroes, these are especially characters who've been around for a long time, like the Black Panther. There's a lot of kind of tweaks and changes as we go. For instance, when they were first creating those original comics, they hadn't really sketched out Wakanda as a place, right? And so they kind of mentioned, oh, he gets his powers from this herb and stuff like that. And he has the stalking suit and these technological abilities and all this gear and gadgets. And Wakanda is, you know, you mentioned Batman and Iron Man have a lot of wealth. Well, one of the things that makes Black Panther kind of special is that he too has a lot of wealth. You know, he mentions early on, like, I have wealth beyond like pretty much anything anybody knows, right? My nation is incredibly prosperous because we have essentially cornered the world supply of vibranium. And over the years, vibranium becomes this metal that everybody wants. It's essentially a clear allegory and a stand-in for everything from gold to uranium and the Cold War and that kind of thing. And it's this metal that has these incredible properties that allow it to absorb energy and kinetic energy and redirect it and things like that. And over time, essentially, it becomes magic, like really like it's magic. Anything the writer wants vibranium to be, that's what it is. But, you know, this is important in the larger context of these stories is that, you know, when you look at the historical sort of carving up of Africa by outside nations and Western nations and that kind of thing, a lot of it was, this was a resource rich continent, right? Precious minerals, diamonds, all these things. This was all other countries coming to trying to come in and take it. And so that becomes a kind of common theme in a lot of Black Panther stories, is essentially T'Challa trying to stand against the forces of colonization, people trying to take vibranium for their own purposes. And so it becomes this thing where vibranium becomes not only the sort of lifeblood of the economy, but also the sort of the lifeblood of the country itself. Over time, it's kind of revealed that the properties of vibranium kind of go into the herb that the Black Panther takes to get his powers. And this becomes a thing where he is sort of innately tied to the land and the resources of that country.
And that power is ancestral. And and this seems to be where the Afrofuturism comes from. But when did Black creators first get their hands on this character, Brian, and begin to grow him, deepen him, and make him more relevant?
So this is a great question because, you know, for a long time, that wasn't the case. Now, I want to be a couple of things as I answer that question. Number one, Marvel loves to tell the story about, oh, we were very socially, you know, aware and very advanced. They weren't. They really didn't do much with Black Panther for a long time. It wasn't, you know, Don McGregor, another white writer, came in, and McGregor, compared to a lot of the rest of the Marvel offices, was a really progressive firebrand. He worked very closely with a lot of Black artists, was friends with them. He wanted to tell a story about Wakanda and make it specifically a story in Africa with African characters when he wrote the Jungle Action series in the 70s. And so he fleshes out a lot of what becomes sort of Wakanda and Wakandan culture. Stuff like the, you know, Killmonger, the Warriors Falls from the movie, all that stuff comes from him, the tribes, the sort of like distrust of outsiders. He delves deeply into that and he tells like this 12-issue story. But it's not really until the 90s that we actually see Black writers and artists really kind of take the lead. The first is actually the late, great Dwayne McDuffie. He was a Black Panther fan growing up. He wrote another character called Deathlok. And, you know, Black Panther didn't have an ongoing series at that time. Again, Marvel didn't really do a whole lot with him apart from a couple of things here and there. But he was a character that people really loved. You know, he's sort of like your favorite comics writer's favorite comics character in a lot of cases. And so, you know, McDuffie was a huge fan growing up. You know, he didn't see a lot of other Black superheroes. And so he talks about, like, this is a character who told me that, you know, Black greatness is possible. It's attainable. You know, it's just really something special. It's not a far-fetched reality. It's something that's right there on the page. And so he writes in a story talking about how, like, you know, Deathlok goes to Wakanda, allies with the Black Panther, talks about how important Black Panther is to him, and by extension, Dwayne McDuffie. And then Christopher Priest comes in the late 90s. And it's funny because so Priest was this, he'd been a longtime comics editor, longtime comics writer. He'd worked for Marvel in DC. And he comes in and, you know, they're relaunching this imprint called Marvel Knights, trying to make sort of darker, more mature, more adult, complex Marvel stories. And they bring him in. He's like, you guys, please don't give me Black Panther, right? He's like, Black writer, Black Panther. I don't want this character, because when he grew up with the character, he was just sort of the afterthought. He was the Avengers token Black friend, basically. And so they're like, well, we want to give you Black Panther. He's just, he's like, you know, he's really upset about this, but he's like, okay, I'm going to try to make this character cool and relevant. And not only to Black audiences and Black creators like myself, but also to the white audience. Right. And so he comes in, and a lot of, honestly, if there are two people who really heavily contribute to what the kind of contemporary popular conception of Black Panther is, it's McGregor and Priest. Priest makes the character cool. He adds a lot of the gadgets. He makes him this kind of mysterious figure. In fact, we don't really get inside his head very much until late in the run. A lot of it is through the sort of white audience surrogate Agent Everett Ross, who is more of a putz in the comics than he is in the movies, you know, and kind of allows him to kind of make all these sort of like offhand jokes about, you know, race relations and politics that are really, really funny. Some haven't aged super well, but some of them are really funny still to this day. You know, and he treats him as this kind of mysterious figure and really makes him, like, he draws a lot of influence from Batman in terms of his gadgets and his cape and that kind of thing. He even gives him like a Joker-like villain. And it's really that run that really kind of makes a lot of people step up and take notice, like, hey, the Black Panther's pretty cool. And then after Priest leaves the book, and it's sort of a long fight between him and Marvel. They make him change a lot of things and try to revamp it constantly because it's not selling crazy well, but it's doing critically very well. Reginald Hudlin, who would then eventually become the president of Black Entertainment Television, another Black Panther fan growing up, takes over the character and says, I'm not going to make this anything other than what I think. He's inspired by Malcolm X. He's inspired by Muhammad Ali, Jay-Z, all these cultural figures. T'Challa, the Black Panther, should be cool. He should be hip. He should be relevant. And he does it. And his book, you know, Christopher Priest said, I was trying really hard to make this character appeal to white audiences. And then Hudlin didn't do that, and his book outsold mine exponentially. And he creates Shuri and brings all in all these other characters, yes. And also makes it really like there's a you know, he's not ashamed to pull political punches. He has an issue where T'Challa and Blade and Luke Cage go down to New Orleans after Katrina to help out with cleanup, and there's a lot of pointed critiques of the Bush administration in there.
Wow.
And they also fight Confederate vampires. So comics.
Wait, and you mentioned the bringing us Shuri, which brings us to the new movie, which is out midnight tonight, Black Panther Wakanda Forever, the sequel to the 2018 original. And it sets it up perfectly for us with our guest, Brian Carr, Associate Professor of Communication, Information Science, Women and Gender Studies at UW Green Bay, author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. And if you saw the original and are looking forward to the sequel, or if you read any of the comic books, let us know what you thought at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and we're continuing our talk with UW Green Bay's Brian Carr about the rise of Black Panther, the socio-political superhero ahead of tomorrow's national release of the movie Black Panther Wakanda Forever. Brian's also the author of the book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. It goes well beyond our discussion here today, which you can still join before we're done with our guest at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we get to the sequel, there's one more character in the real world that really had an impact on the Black Panther character in the Marvel Universe, and that is the person who played him in the original 2018 movie, Chadwick Boseman. How did Chadwick change this character, Brian?
So I think you cannot overstate how impactful Chadwick Boseman is. And in the book, I make the case that, you know, we talk a lot about writers and artists and creators, but I think that Boseman and director Ryan Coogler have a tremendous amount of impact, maybe even more than some of the artists and writers, in terms of the cultural consciousness of the character. Here is an actor who fought behind the scenes to do things like, they wanted Black Panther to speak with a British accent. He said, no, that makes no sense. This is a character who comes from an uncolonized nation. He shouldn't speak with a British accent. He fought for the Wakandan language to be a real language. They speak Xhosa, a real African language in the film. The most impactful line from the original film, where Killmonger is about to die and he says to be buried at sea with his ancestors who jumped rather than suffer bondage. That was apparently also Boseman's doing. So this is a man who is not only, you know, playing a character on screen, he was really, truly creatively crafting this character. And in a collaborative sense with the writers and the director of the film. And so it was a tremendous loss when he passed, because this is a guy who really was and embodied all the best elements of this character.
So what do we know about how they're handling the death of Chadwick Boseman in this sequel, Brian?
It is difficult to get anything out of Marvel. So we know for sure that there is a new Black Panther in the film. And this, again, squares with the comics. A Black Panther is a title, not a person. There will be a new Black Panther. We know the Black Panther is likely female. Now, if you are a fan of the comics, you know that his sister Shuri does take over as Black Panther for a while. And then, of course, becomes kind of her own thing when Ta-Nehisi Coates takes over the series for a few years. So the smart money as well, you know, she's going to be the new Black Panther. And I have no idea. I am not privy to any of this. Marvel did not invite me to the premiere. I'm going to guess that she's on the short list of who's going to replace it. And again, this is a story about legacy, in a lot of ways, not just in terms of what the character is in the story, but the legacy of Chadwick Boseman and the larger cultural movement and moment that the original film was. So I think that, you know, it's going to be something where whoever this person is going to symbolically represent that. And as director Cooler says, earn it as well.
Mm. And you mentioned Killmonger, played by Michael B. Jordan in the original 2018 movie, was such a powerful antagonist. Mm-hmm. What do we know about the antagonist that the Black Panther and Wakanda will go up against in this sequel?
You can't see, but I'm smiling really big right now because I'm so excited for this guy. Namor is essentially the king of an underwater nation. It's Atlantis in the comics. It's Talokan in the film. Rather than kind of copy, even though, you know, I always like to tell people Aquaman's the cheap copy of Namor. He came out years after, but Aquaman made a movie first. So they kind of had to reinvent some things about this character. And so they're going with a character who's heavily influenced by Mesoamerican culture, heavily draws from Aztec and Mayan folklore and myth. And again, kind of represents, this is a person who has his own kingdom to look out for. He has a lot of beef with the surface world because we have, of course, poisoned the oceans. We have done all these things. And I don't know what his specific problem with Wakanda is yet, but he represents this kind of thing where he is sort of, in a lot of ways, the inverse of T'Challa, or in some ways the same person, but with a bit of a different moral center. He's traditionally, in his original incarnation, is an anti-hero. He's often been a villain, but he's one of my favorite Marvel characters because he is just this very fascinating, you know, you never quite know where he's going to go. I think they're trying to make him more of a noble anti-hero in this film, and I think that's a good angle. Tanakh Huerta's playing him, and really bringing a lot of, you know, they're bringing a lot of the culture, the language. They worked very closely with actual scholars to pay tribute to and be inspired by that culture, which, again, is very much in line with what they did with African culture in the first film. So, you know, it's going to be a really interesting way to see how they bring this character in and modernize him.
Brian Carr, do you have your tickets yet?
I do. Yeah, we got them. We're making a whole afternoon of it.
Our guest is the author of The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. Brian Carr is also an associate professor at UW Green Bay. And Namor is something you're looking forward to. What else are you anticipating in this sequel?
I'm really curious thematically. So I will say this, you know, I think Black Panther in general is kind of a cut above the rest of the Marvel output because it is trying to be a bit more about these heavy ideas and these larger things that are beyond just, you know, the sort of like basic surface level notions of heroism. So what I really want to see is the things that Black Panther does historically well, to talk about the ideas of legacy and power and leadership, to talk about the ideas of, you know, colonization and, you know, how do you right the wrongs of the past? This is something that Ta-Nehisi Coates gets into deeply in his Black Panther run, talking about, like, you know, building on his essay, like, you know, the case for reparations and that kind of thing, talking about the legacy of Wakanda. Is Wakanda itself a good thing? You know, and just casting all of this alongside the idea of grief and loss is really powerful. So I'm really curious to see one, obviously, who the new Black Panther is going to be, but two, how the story goes forward from here. Because there are a lot of different angles and they're introducing a lot of different elements. And we know from what Ryan Coogler has said is that the story is not radically different than the one he had originally turned in, assuming Boseman was going to reprise the role. But it is going to take on a different weight and a different resonance in this context. It's one of those examples where we cannot really separate fiction from the context in which it is written.
Yeah. So do we know what's next for this franchise, Brian?
We have some ideas. In the comics, we are currently undergoing a story arc where T'Challa is kind of persona non grata in Wakanda. And there is this question about like what to do when that vacuum of leadership occurs. Will there be a new Black Panther? Killmonger is being teased to come back. We are also, even though he's dead in the movies, he's still alive in the comics. Nobody ever stays dead in the comics, by the way. Like, it's just like you like dying is like a temporary illness. Like, you get better real quick. But, you know, in the films, we know that there is going to be a Disney Plus series set in Wakanda called, I believe it's called World of Wakanda, but they might have changed that. We don't know exactly what it's going to be about, but presumably we're going to be seeing some stories either from Wakandan history, which could be really, really exciting, or are going to be delving more into the culture and kind of like the, you know, what it's like to be not necessarily the king or the people at the top, but also just like what Wakandan culture and what stories from that place are like. That's going to be a series coming up. I believe Ryan Coogler is going to be very closely involved with that. And of course, these characters are always going to crop up and show up in other media. You know, there's a very good case to be made that, you know, what happens in this film is going to have traumatic implications for the next several years of these films. I've already teased that. So, you know, even though the secrets are what they are, I think that we are certainly going to see a lot more of Black Panther and Wakanda in the future. Possibly even, you know, maybe we will see a different actor take on the mantle once they've had some time to kind of properly process the loss.
It is an entire universe that is open to us, but it also is a part of our universe as well. And the ties between them are fascinating, Brian, and I thank you so much for sharing them with us today.
Thank you.
Brian Carr is an associate professor of communication, information science, and women and gender studies at UW Green Bay. Talk to him today about his book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King, which goes well beyond our conversation here today. We didn't even get to the video games, the TV, and Kendrick Lamar's album, but it's all available for you through his book, The Transmedia Construction of the Black Panther, Long Live the King. Tomorrow is the national release of the Black Panther sequel, Wakanda Forever. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's Food Friday. And I'm getting ready. Our guest will be taking us on a guided tour of the Mediterranean, filling up our pantry, adding to our spice rack, and making the smoothest, fluffiest hummus tomorrow on Central Time. Now, coming up after the news, the authors of the new book, What's Your Grief, share advice on helping to recognize different kinds of grief in ourselves, in others, and how we can cope ourselves and with others. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, political pundits inaccurately predicted widespread Republican victories in the midterm elections, and we'll critique the media coverage and explore why we got it wrong. But first, our next guests are trying to expand our understanding about what grief is and what we can do about it, what different kinds of things we can grieve over. We can grieve the loss of a loved one, of course, but we can also feel grief over non-death loss, the end of a relationship, the end of a marriage, infertility or a miscarriage, the loss of a version of someone you love due to mental illness, substance abuse, all examples, and perhaps you can relate to some. We want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. How do you go about handling loss? Are you struggling with handling it? And are you able to recognize when you are grieving? Whether it's death or non-death related losses, what advice would you give to others? Join in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. Our guests, Eleanor Haley and Litza Williams, are Baltimore-based mental health professionals and co-founders of the website What's Your Grief? Their new book is called What's Your Grief? List to help you through any loss. Eleanor and Litza, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and Eleanor, I'll begin with you. We talked with you on Central Time about 3 years ago now about your online community that you've built. And what made you want to write a book about grief as well?
Oh, gosh. Well, in that time, something pretty big happened where there was an awful lot of loss. And I think we all know what I'm talking about. COVID happened in the past 3 years since we last spoke. And so up until around 2019, 2020, we had been, you know, writing in on our website, in our online community, doing lots of virtual stuff. And then around 2020, we were approached about writing a book, taking a lot of what we write about on our website and turning it into something that would be actually tangible in book form. And we had been approached over the years a couple of times and never really saw what we had to offer to the grief book space. There are so many different books out there. And so at that time when we were approached in 2020, I think we saw one gap in the grief book literature, and that was a book that would validate and normalize the wide range of grief experiences there are out there. At the time, people were, of course, experiencing countless, unfortunately, death losses, but also a lot of non-death loss, loss of job, loss of relationships, and the list goes on. And so we really said, you know what, I think now's the time. We've always recognized that non-death losses is a really big and important experience that needs to be grieved. And I think the world might be ready to acknowledge that as well. And so that's why we decided to take the step we did.
Yes. What's Your Grief? List to help you through any loss. And Litza Williams, why were lists a good framework to work from?
I think it's really interesting. We spend a lot of time talking about how complex grief is and how it's so much more nuanced than many people believe. And then to say we've written a book that's in the format of lists, I think is surprising to people. But one of the things that we know is that because grief is so overwhelming, it touches so many areas of our lives, so many people process it differently, taking it step by step, one thing at a time, can really be an effective approach to trying to understand our own grief, to try to understand others' grief, and to find ways to cope with and manage the losses that we're facing in life. And so over the years, we had heard people come to our website who said, I picked up grief books and they were so dense, they were so overwhelming, it was too much, I couldn't concentrate. What I loved about your website was that you had these manageable, approachable articles that were sometimes in list form that really helped me to be able to find something digestible. And these aren't just like bullet pointed lists. They obviously are a little more complex than that. But we do think that this format for people who are feeling so overwhelmed and so overcome by the emotions of grief really does lend itself well to helping them apply and connect to their own lives.
And Eleanor, why do you think we have such a problem understanding our own grief?
Well, I think there's a lot of answers to that question. But one of the main things is that we grow up with a lot of beliefs and assumptions around what it means to experience loss and what grief looks like. And unfortunately, what we enter into grief assuming things will look like often does not match the experience. There's a lot of myths and misconceptions out there about grief. The number one that we always hear about is that idea that grief will be uniform, it will follow a set of stages, it will be linear, and it will have some sort of endpoint where we're expected to put everything behind us. And that's just not how grief works. So I think one of the things that makes grief so difficult is just it's very much an unexpected experience and overwhelming in ways we never anticipate. It's not just about feeling painful emotion. Grief impacts every single domain of our life, logistical, spiritual, worldview, relationships, it impacts everything. And people aren't always ready or expecting that experience.
Or are they even aware of their own grief?
Well, I think I would.
I think that the.
I'm sorry, Litza was starting there. And Litza, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, to add to what Eleanor said, I think that oftentimes they aren't aware of their own grief, or they aren't labeling what they're experiencing as grief because they think grief only follows a death. You know, in those expectations Eleanor was just describing, I think one of the most fundamental expectations people have is just grief is something that happens after a loved one dies, and we expect that we will feel it then for sort of a finite period of time. And I think people are often really surprised to experience these other things in life where they have tremendous loss. And even though they feel it as a loss, they might not necessarily recognize that they're grieving that loss and that it's appropriate and important to be able to label it as grief and understand that that is what we're going through.
That's Litza Williams also joining us, Eleanor Haley. They are mental health professionals and co-founders of the online support group What's Your Grief and authors of the new book What's Your Grief? List to help you through any loss. And if you have any suggestions or questions, you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We're Bill in Milwaukee standing by. Bill, you're on Central Time.
Hello, glad to talk with you. You know, I think that when we're in grief, and I agree with you, grief is not just for death. But whenever I've had to face it with my friends or with my own self, it seems that the simplest things are the best. I was watching The Hobbit just today, and Bilbo said, "When there's nothing around you but death, there's nothing to do but go on living. You know, what else can you do?"
But that almost sounds like denial or rejection of grief or just plowing ahead and ignoring your own feelings. You might want to stop and think about that for a second. And I'd be interested in your reaction, Eleanor.
Well, I think what that kind of resonates with in my mind is that sense of a little bit of a sense of maybe shock and numbness and uncertainty about where to even begin. And as the caller said, sometimes the simplest things are where we really have to start. And people often think that in grief, they have to have these really big coping tools and these really big deep dives into their emotion. And what we actually find is that grief is often about just taking things one little step at a time, day by day, and acknowledging that it's going to be a couple of steps forward and a couple of steps back. And that is what the grief journey, so to speak, looks like.
Litza Williams, I would ask you, one of the quotes from your book, Viktor Frankl, an abnormal reaction to an abnormal situation is just normal behavior. How do you recognize grief? How do you see it, find it, identify it?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we try to encourage people to remember is that grief is our normal and natural response to loss. And when we look for that in ourselves, it can come out in so many different ways. It can come out in just thinking about how our identity is changing, thinking about after losses that have occurred in our lives, we may start to recognize, wow, I see the world differently. I used to believe that if, bad things only happen to bad people, or that if I sort of did the right thing, that the right thing would always happen. You know, I might see some shifts in my worldview. I might feel a loss of my self-confidence because someone in my life who was my cheerleader is not a part of my life anymore. And so it might be in these identity changes and role changes that we have. It might be in experiences where we just realize it feels a little bit more like anxiety because something has happened to us where we know the worst can happen now. We've lost a loved one. We've had, a devastating event happen, and suddenly we approach the world as feeling more uncertain than it was before. And we know that bad things can happen. So there's the things that people, I think, expect, feeling sadness, feeling, those emotions. But sometimes it's looking for these other things that are important. It's sometimes knowing that when we feel numb, that can be grief too. Sometimes people will say, "I'm not grieving. I feel numb. I haven't cried. What's wrong with me?" And sometimes that is our brain's way of coping and sort of giving us the distance that we need from the emotions in order to function day to day. And that is part of our grief, is that numbness. And that with time, we might need to look for safe, comfortable spaces where we can, either with a counselor or with friends or family members, acknowledge the loss and talk about it and maybe start to let those emotions in a little bit. So there's no one way to recognize it, but I think looking for any different angle at which we might be responding to a loss that has happened in our life.
It reminds me of another quote. And Bill, you brought up The Hobbit. I'll bring up Mr. Fred Rogers. And this quote is directly from our guest book, What's Your Grief? List to help you through any loss. And Mr. Rogers said, "There is no should or should not when it comes to having feelings. They're part of who we are beyond our control. When we believe that, we may find it easier to make constructive choices about what to do with those feelings." Yeah. And that's where we stand this afternoon with Eleanor Haley and Litza Williams, our guest, Baltimore-based mental health professionals and co-founders of the website What's Your Grief? New book, What's Your Grief? List to help you through any loss. Why lists? Part of the coping mechanisms. And you can join the conversation as we look at signs of progress and coping at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guests about grief and coping with it? Our conversation continues next on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret, and we're picking up our conversation with Eleanor Haley and Litza Williams, a pair of Baltimore-based mental health professionals, co-founders of the online support group What's Your Grief, talking about their new book, What's Your Grief? List to help you through any loss. And you can join us at any time at 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@wpr.org. And we've been talking about loss, both in terms of death and non-death related. And as you write in your book, that sometimes coping with non-death related loss and non-death related loss grieving can be more difficult than death related loss. Eleanor, why is that?
I think it's just difficult in many similar ways, but in many very different ways. And oftentimes, I think Litza already mentioned the fact that people don't always recognize that they're even grieving a loss. And if you yourself aren't recognizing that you're grieving a loss, it stands to reason that the people around you won't always recognize, validate, support, or give you the time and space that you need to grieve that loss. So many times people feel that their non-death losses are disenfranchised. They're not acknowledged. They're not supported. So they often end up grieving them alone and many times wondering what's wrong with me that I'm struggling so much with this. I think another thing that can make non-death loss hard, especially when it's grieving a person who is still alive, such as maybe somebody who has a severe traumatic brain injury, dementia, perhaps somebody who's ran away, is just that you're doing two things at once. You're grieving the change in the relationship, you're grieving the loss, but at the same time, you're dealing with the ongoing stress and you're holding on to that hope that things will get better. Maybe they'll come back to you. So there are just a lot of different dynamics that go into grieving a non-death loss that people don't always consider and people don't always offer or receive support for.
Litza Williams, there is a quote from your book that has stuck with me as perhaps one of the most challenging things for those who are trying to cope with their grief. Sometimes you have to help people help you. How do you do that?
Oh, yeah, this is really can be a frustrating thing for people who are grieving. You realize people are saying the wrong thing, they're doing the wrong thing, and it can feel so frustrating because you just want that support. But sometimes people's instincts are wrong. People's instincts are they want to take away our pain. And so they start saying things like, oh, well, you know, at least you can have other children, or at least you're still young, you'll meet someone else. You know, they say these really hurtful things, or they say general, you know, sort of vague things about how things will get better. And sometimes we have to do a little bit of educating people, and that can be hard when we're grieving, but it's a reality that people don't know what we need if we don't tell them what we need. So sometimes we have to spend a little time with that, and we have to think, wow, if I'm frustrated by my support system, if I feel like they've abandoned me or they're always getting it wrong, what feedback could I get them, give them to help them maybe understand my grief a little bit better and understand what I personally need. So being able to say to someone, hey, I know you were just trying to cheer me up when you said that, or find a silver lining. But right now, what I need is for you to just kind of be present with me and to understand that nothing is going to make this feel better right now. I just need you to kind of hear me or listen to me or be a shoulder for me to cry on. Or maybe to say, you know, I really need practical support right now. I'm really, really struggling with getting the lawn mowed and my taxes done this year and things my partner used to help me with. So that's the kind of stuff that I really need from you. I don't need you to keep, you know, bringing casseroles over or whatever it might be. So to give people a little bit of that feedback and guidance so that we can get, you know, what we need from other people and so that they can feel good that they're supporting us in the ways that we need.
And when people come to you with the best of intentions and you are able to redirect them, I don't know anybody that wouldn't be willing to redirect themselves as long as they're coming to you true, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think people want to be able to help us in our grief. They just often don't know how to do it. And it's hard to watch someone struggle and suffer. So we sometimes fumble through. Like, none of us got a handbook on how to grieve, and none of us got a handbook on how to support someone grieving. So we have to be able to kind of communicate through it.
I am vigorously and quietly nodding. Let's go back to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Jeff in Superior is standing by. Jeff, you're on the air with Eleanor Haley and Litsa Williams.
Wow, this is great. Thank you for this opportunity. I formed an opinion in my older years that there's different kinds of grief. So, for example, I can grieve for a person that I've known, a family member, things like that. Then that grief might be triggered by a memory or something. So, in other words, I don't know I'm feeling grief yet. But I've also found that as an American, as a community, I still feel like I'm grieving John F. Kennedy's assassination or Martin Luther King not being part of our country. So, is it true that there's like personal grief and then collective grief?
Oh wow, I feel as though you have read the book, Jeff. Eleanor.
Yes, absolutely. We can grieve for anything that we have an attachment to. And so it might be an ideal, it might be a worldview, and it might be a public figure. So absolutely. And we actually, interestingly, we have one article on our website that's, I can't remember the exact title, but titled something like, Is it wrong to grieve a celebrity death? And I cannot tell you how much traffic we have to that article and how many comments we have, because people are having that experience, but it's often, again, an experience that gets invalidated. So you are absolutely right. There are definitely different things that will cause us grief, whether it is somebody who is very close to us or somebody we're a little more distant from. And we're often surprised by the losses that really cause us a lot of struggle. And I just think it's important for people to understand that grief is, it's on a spectrum where there are big losses that turn our lives upside down, that shatter almost everything, it seems. And then there are smaller losses that are hard, but that we have support and ways to cope with and integrate more easily. So it's totally normal to experience loss and grief over these wide range of things.
Eleanor Haley and Litsa Williams run the online support group What's Your Grief, and the authors of the new book What's Your Grief, List to Help You Through Any Loss. Back to you now, Lauren in Algoma. You're on Central Time.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Awesome. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I just want to thank both the speakers for talking about non-death related grief. I think the biggest grief that I've suffered is a divorce. And it's so taboo to talk about how that's a grieving process. And my best friend recently went through one, and she felt the same way. I mean, you grieve the loss of your past because that person has changed. You grieve the loss of the person because you can no longer be with them. And you grieve the loss of your future, too, everything that you thought you'd had. And I've had a much harder time processing that than I have, you know, the death of a grandparent, for example, where they're not there anymore. They passed peacefully, things like that.
Yeah, Lauren, I thank you so much for sharing your story. And how important is that best friend to you? And where do you think your coping process would be without her? No, I think I lost you. Litsa, what's your thought about Lauren's story about going through a divorce and finding this to be a challenge, but having that best friend there who's going through the same thing?
Yeah, I think we cannot say enough about how, especially these losses that feel disenfranchised, that feel like people don't validate them or understand them, when we can find someone to connect with who has that same experience and who is willing to talk about it and acknowledge it, that can be so incredibly helpful. It's one of the reasons that, especially for losses that are a little more invalidated, that support groups can be so helpful. If you're not lucky enough to have that friend who gets it, a support group can sometimes fill that space. And we do know that oftentimes with grief, you know, I completely understand, as somebody who has gone through, lost, you know, a lot of people really close to me in my life, I understand that there's this instinct to kind of protect the word grief for death-related losses. Because when you've been through that, people want to say, oh no, divorce, you know, it's not right to call divorce because death is worse, death is harder. You know, they're all different, like Eleanor said, and they're all on a spectrum. And sometimes when we feel like we can't use the word grief for divorce, we then aren't able to connect with people over that shared experience of feeling those exact losses that the caller described, the life we thought we would have together, these shared memories, our sense of self, you know, who am I now if I'm not a wife anymore, if I'm not a partner in this same way? Does this undo the past that we had together? You know, there's so many things to cope with, and it really does become helpful when we can label it for what it is and find other people to help support us through it.
Litza and Eleanor, thank you so much for joining us today. Litza Williams and Eleanor Haley are Baltimore-based mental health professionals and co-founders of the website What's Your Grief. We talked with them about their new book, What's Your Grief? List to help you through any loss. And coming up after the news, we'll talk to a media and politics professor about the election coverage this fall and why pundits were wrong about predicting a red wave of Republican victories. It was near unanimous what was going to happen on Tuesday night, but those results were far from the prognosticators. What's the discrepancy? I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. News is next. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.